listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor, at gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Peter Granich. Peter's been a guest of this show before, but I'm actually anticipating having Peter with us perhaps once a month or so in the foreseeable future. So starting next month, I guess Peter will probably be back with us. You know, the title of this program is Turning Hard Times into Good Times. The trouble is, most of the time, the subject matter that we deal with on this show is based not so much on good times as it is on a world in moral, political, and economic decay. When our focus just on the realities of this fallen world with no hope for anything beyond the four dimensions of time and space that we mere mortals can comprehend, well, life can be quite a bummer at times and very depressing, for sure. The standard idea that we have and we've been given to by our mainstream media and by our society in general is that in order to be happy and have lots of fun in life, to enjoy life to its fullest, you need to have lots of money, lots of power, fame, maybe good looks. You need to be praised by other people. But some of the least happy people are those who have made their money or fame or power, made those items their God. And no one knows that better than Peter Granich, my good friend, whom I've known for upwards to 30 years now, I guess, but with no formal education. You know, Peter entered Wall Street in the mid-1980s, and within 3 years, he was appointed Vice President of Investment Strategy for a leading New York Stock Exchange member firm. And given his success as a market forecaster, he was a frequent guest on national television and he became, you know, a big star. So Peter had a taste of fame and fortune, but that wasn't always bringing him the true happiness and the kind of peace and joy in life that he craved. But over the past several years, Peter has found much of what he has been looking for in all the wrong places. And I'd say that through his Christian faith, he has been able to, in fact, turn hard times into good times, at least as he now defines good times. I should mention before we start talking to Peter that he is a regular guest every Friday on the Drew Mariani Show. That's a Catholic radio station called Relevant Radio. I listen to it frequently when I'm driving around town. You can listen to it, I think, in the New York City area, probably in some of the Midwestern towns, Chicago, maybe up in Wisconsin. I'm not sure where all, but you can listen to it as well at relevantradio.com. And Peter is on there with Drew Mariani every Friday between 3 and 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's my understanding that Peter is one of their biggest draws, and so he's on, I think, almost every Friday. In addition to getting Peter's take on the economy here on when we talk to him here over the next several weeks or months, we want to talk to him not only about, you know, some of the market issues and ideas, which I do want to ask him about those, but also some of the intangible things in life that can and has made a more peaceful, fulfilling, and joyous life for Peter. In the hope that perhaps some of it can rub off on us and we may be able to learn some of the things that Peter has learned through the hard knocks of life that he's gone through. So anyway, Peter, thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to talking to you on a regular basis.
Well, thank you, Jay, and it's just about 30 years ago when I first met you, so time has flown in some instances, and sometimes it feels like it's a long, long time ago.
Yeah, it seems like just yesterday to me, and I can remember. When I first learned to know you, I think it was pretty much the miraculous birth of your daughter too. I mean, she wasn't expected to make it. I think, I don't remember the details of that, Peter, but I remember that there was great
concern.
Sure,
what actually happened was we met after the crash in '87, which kind of gave me the claim to fame and the subsequent rise. I was actually invited to then when it was the New York Gold Show before it went to Boston and then came back. And I actually met you then, and you started to come down and do some charity conferences I had down on the Jersey Shore.
Yes.
And you're right. My daughter, my wife, in a fifth month of pregnancy, was diagnosed as a child was going to be spinal bifida, but through what we believe was a Catholic healing mass, a great healing was done, and when she was born, she was fine. And we've known each other ever since, and of course, we spent many, probably two and a half decades seeing each other every few months at investment conferences around the world.
Yeah, for sure. Vancouver, Toronto, we've been out in San Francisco and down in California, down in Arizona, places like that. I know, Peter. So, yeah, it's really great to hear these things. You know, I mean, most people, what is really easy for us to understand, Peter, are the four dimensions of time and space. Well, that's not so easy either. I mean, science is still discovering things, the amazing aspects of our world. So even within the four dimensions of time and space, it's not so easy to understand. But at least we can get a handle on that. What most people can't understand, and what, in fact, I think we've been taught to believe by our secular humanist society, is that there isn't any existence outside of the four dimensions of time and space. And so I know that you and I both believe there are, that there is an existence beyond our life here on Earth, and that really makes all the difference in the world, I think. If you don't believe that, then what the heck? Just go for it, right? And see what you can get away with, and go for what the world decides is going to make you happy. All this money and power and fame, things that people really want to have. But I know that you and I have both, you know, have both talked about this in the past. Before we get, I want to ask you about the seven deadly sins of finance, which I guess you've discovered probably through your own experiences, right, Peter? That's where you came to those.
So, but I'd like to just respond real quickly to what something you just said. I'm often asked. I've spent the last 15 years becoming engrossed in my Catholic Christian faith, and I'm often, you know, meet people who don't have the same beliefs, and rather than try to beat into their mind, I share the thought of this, and that there's really only three possibilities of what's going to transpire. What we or what some religion believes is what it's going to be. Religion, ours or all of them, is just poppycock, and it's just, you know, made up, and yeah, we just cease to exist. Or three, it's something we don't know. And I always like to say that, well, if it's the second one, well, it won't matter what we thought, whether we believed or not, we'll just go poof.
Yeah.
If it's something we don't know, then the only thing I got to go on is that ever arranged that also arranged this earth and the universe and so forth. So I have a feeling that that is something fairly good, because there was a lot of good built here. Man might have changed it into bad, but what was built and what was created was good. And if it's the first, what we believe, well, then that's, you know, really something to think about, because it has an upside and it has a downside. But someone want to ask me, well, what if it isn't true? And I've learned that living a Christian life, whether it's going to lead to what we believe it is or not, is just a better way to live. Mm-hmm. And it's opened up and has given me a peace, especially in these last few years, that when worth and fame and fortune was much higher and measured in man's eyes than it is now for me, I didn't have one-tenth the peace and happiness that I have now. So for me, and that's all I can do, I can just share what's worked for me.
Sure.
And if people feel it's something that they like to know more of, then they will. And if not, well, that's their choice. That's what I believe the Creator, one of the many great gifts He's given us, and that's freedom of choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the last thing that we want to do, or anybody should want to do, is to try to force other people into believing. It's certainly not what Christ taught, Jesus taught when he was on earth. It was a matter of free will. So we all have that will. Well, before I ask you about some of these seven deadly sins of finance, I'd like you to talk a little bit, Peter, about your formative years, because and before you get into that, let me just mention the book that you've written, the Confessions of a Former Wall Street Whiz Kid. People can pick up this book where, Peter? Because it is a remarkable read, and I want to get into the first chapter of this, a little bit about your formative years, but where can people pick up this book?
Well, they can do two things. If they like, they can purchase it on Amazon, but it is available, if they don't mind reading it online, at our website, petergranich.com, and if you go down the left side, you'll see it says Peter's Book. And you can literally read it online for free. You don't have to provide anything, not even an email, and they can read it there as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk. Chapter one deals with your youth, the formative years, and you were the most unlikely sort of a guy to have fame and fortune on Wall Street, given your upbringing. Talk a little bit about that, if
sure.
you would, Peter.
Born to a non-practicing Catholic father and non-practicing Jewish mother, I never had an ounce of any religious training. I was baptized, and then my mother believed she wanted to raise me Jewish. My father would have nothing to do with it, and I would have no other religious experience until eventually at age 23 I would meet my future wife, who was born and raised in Ireland, was asked to get married by her father in Ireland, and I had to become Catholic in order to do that. But you're right, how I entered, I didn't finish high school. I, in fact, was a warehouse manager and had a penny stock broker. I turned a small amount of money into a fairly large sum trading stock options, only to lose the entire sum through the penny stock broker. However, I got an insight to what was then, we would call back then, stockbrokers, and I felt that I wanted to be one. And in March of 1984, I became one. And it was very unusual. Still to this day, the majority of people are either Wharton School or MBAs or highly educated. And here was this kid from the Bronx who really had more fun in the disco than any other place. And I know you mentioned the picture that's in there when I was about over 50 pounds lighter, Disco Pete. But I literally lived for the weekend, and here I was, a young man that had trouble with two or three syllable words or larger, competing with Harvard and other types of folks. And what really happened was, and what really started everything, Jay, was I couldn't cold call. Back then, cold call was the lifeline of a stockbroker, so
sure.
I literally started what became known as the Grandage Newsletter, in lieu of calling people, writing down thoughts and ideas and publishing it. I got discovered by a branch manager of a New York Stock Exchange firm. I worked my way onto the old Financial News Network before there was CNBC, and then got promoted to head of investment strategy, and then wrote a famous, for me anyway, piece in August of 87 about a coming crash. The crash occurred in October of 1987, and on the next day, I made a forecast that the market would recover within 2 years, and yada, yada, yada. And that was really the beginning of what led to, to where we are today.
Yeah, I might mention also, and we want to get into this, if not today, sometime in the near future, Peter, some of your other activities. Now, as I look through your book, I'm seeing some famous athletes that you've become familiar with, and some of these also, I guess, share your Christian faith, and you've been involved with them. We'll talk about that in the future, but I'm looking here, Eli Manning, a picture of Eli Manning with your daughter, and really great. I would just tell people that they should pick up a copy or go to Peter's website and look at Confessions of a Former Wall Street Whiz Kid. Well, Peter, let's talk a little bit about the seven deadly sins that you mentioned, the seven deadly
sure.
sins of finance. Now, as I understand, these are things that you sort of got into, you sort of learned the hard way, or learned by the school of hard knocks. Believing you can predict future market movements is the first one.
Right. So what has transpired is, I like to say, after being a legend in my own mind and turning the Ten Commandments into the Ten Suggestions, losing millions not once but twice, and in a sense getting to the point where depression led to hospitalization and a lost will to live, I think I can speak from somewhat of an authority about mistakes. And so I came up with, because I believe everything now is led through my Christian faith, I came up with what I call the seven deadly sins of finance. And the very first one, pretty well knocks me out of the box to be involved in anything that I used to do, whether it's investment conferences, appearing in the media and what have you, because I concluded for myself that one of the seven deadly sins is believing I could predict and continuously predict future market movements. In fact, the third edition of the book, which you refer to, the first two editions was called Confessions of a Wall Street Whiz Kid. I changed it to a former because Whiz Kid gave people perception that somehow I was somewhat very smart or maybe knew the future, and 30 years has taught me no one but God knows the future. So I think it's very, very dangerous to expect and to believe that people on a regular basis can predict the future. And we know that from a factual situation, Jay, and that is that 80% of active money managers, managers who are, when we say active versus passive, then it's not an index fund, it's someone is moving money in and out of different places and things, 80% in stocks and 85% in bond fund managers don't perform equally to diversified index funds. And in stocks, the 20% that beat it this year, 90-something percent don't beat it next year. So for me, it seemed futile to stay on a belief that I could do that and actively manage money and be successful other than for myself, because I would always still make money from commissions or fees or what have you.
Sure.
So I've concluded for my sake and anybody that cared to listen, the first deadly sin is to believe we know the future. Only God really knows the future.
Right. Well, that's I totally agree with you there. Having said that, we just talked to Michael Oliver, who's on this show almost every week, and Michael has had a remarkable track record as a technical analyst, but he's not really calling definite prices. He's looking, as time goes on, to his momentum readers, and he's suggesting where people should be cautious and when they might add or when they might reduce their positions.
I think you're entitled to go out and speculate and say, well, I think this can happen. What I think the mistake is to think anyone or group will constantly be able to do that on a regular basis. And, and it actually falls into number two, if it would be so kind.
Yes, please, go ahead,
that. The second one is what we call utilizing traditional financial planning methods. Almost all financial plans that I see people do, and this is no disrespect to any individual or even a type of group, but this is the generalization of how Wall Street works. When you and I started, we had pads and a pen. Now it's 400-page computer printouts with all sorts of charts and graphs and bells and whistles. But at the end of the day, in order for a financial plan to work, there were four factors that would make it up. Interest rates, tax rates, inflation rates, and rates of returns. Those four things would impact what's going to happen with your wealth and portfolio and et cetera than any other factors. Well, if you look back to number one, since no one can actually predict those on a regular basis, eventually one or more of those factors will not be judged right. What happens in our business and what keeps those of us in the business living pretty well is, when eventually we do wrong and someone gets upset and they leave, someone got upset and left someone else, and that person came to me. And so it's a spinning wheel, but we just don't believe it can work. Well, I've concluded that the best I could ever do as a planner is make the Chevy run the way the manual said. I can't make the Chevy into a Cadillac, and unfortunately, for much of my life and much of what I saw the industry, it gave an allure that they can turn a Chevy into a Cadillac, and it just doesn't happen. And if it happens, it happens too infrequent, and most people don't get to participate in it.
Right. So that's the marketing ploy, though, that you're going to turn the Chevy into a Cadillac.
Or something even more.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's go for, while we're at it, let's go for a Rolls Royce. The third one is assuming financial advice is unbiased and objective. Well, when I write about companies, I certainly try to do that as best I can. But I guess what you're saying is that you really need to realize that people who are writing these reports for these brokerage firms and so forth are probably not necessarily having their clients' best their best wishes in mind? Is that what you're saying?
It is that at times. It doesn't mean, let's take you for example. I'm only on here, and you know I've divorced myself from pretty well everybody and anything that I once was involved with, but you always have been in my book the exception to the rule. I have no doubt that when you sit there, you don't sit there contemplating, let me say this because someone's going to buy into it and I make a dollar. What mm-hmm. I'm saying in this part of point is just remember, just like in everything else, somebody has some sort of personal motive for what they're doing. I watched people, I remember us at conferences, and we could give a talk, and by the time we're done, the audience is not only invested in what we talked about, but they spent the imaginary money they expect it's going to make and already have plans of what they're going to do with it. And you and I both know that, I think anyway, you and I were the exception to the rule on some of the places we went. I think there uh-huh. was a lot of bias information that wasn't being shared and people weren't disclosing. I mean, the big joke about me, people used to say, is my disclaimer was longer than my commentary.
Uh-huh.
But the bottom line is just don't treat it across the board that way. And unfortunately, a lot of people place, you know, there's a guy on TV that rings bells and does other crazy stuff, and anybody that's been with him a long time realizes he's not very good at it, but he's entertaining, and for a while people get hooked into that, and they think because he's on a national network show, he must be smart, and before they know it, they're involved, and it doesn't take too long before they wish they weren't. But so I just remember to tell people, just remember, there is potential for bias and maybe not total objectiveness.
All right. The fourth one that you have listed here is the sin of arrogance. It seems to me would go with perhaps the first one as well. But talk to us about that, the sin of arrogance.
We're running out of time, so I want to get through them. This one is where hubris, and even I was very guilty of it, comes involved. And that is that we think we're all knowing. And I remember, Jay, when the market didn't go in the right way, the market was doing something wrong, not me. I was never wrong. The market just didn't do what it was supposed to do, and that's a form of arrogance. And arrogance is a deadly sin, not just in finances, but in life itself.
No doubt about it. The big lie, more money equals more happiness. Well, you and I both know that's not true.
I heard you say that, and you cannot be more accurate. Wall Street would have you believe that the guy driving the bus can never be as happy as the guy that owns the bus company.
Yeah.
And all the commercials and everything you watch is driven, the hidden belief is we can make you more money and it'll lead to what all the things you want to do. But in real life, some of the most unhappiest people are the people with the most money. In fact, some of the happiest people I've met are people with little or no money. So I believe a deadly sin is simply think what Wall Street tries to teach, and that more money will equal more happiness.
Yeah, it seems the people that don't have money sort of take the joy in the little things in life, the family, their wives, their kids, simple things, and that really is, I think, where real happiness comes from. We're not telling people to throw away your money. We're supposed to be good stewards of it, and I hope to talk to you about that sometime in the future too, Peter, to get some of your counsel on how we can take care of the gifts that you and I believe are given to us by God. How do we best take care of those and nurture them and grow them as we're supposed to too, but not at the expense of the other values. So the sixth one is participating in mental anguish. I know that's something that you definitely went through at times in the past.
Well, not only had I gone through it, but I probably over the years were not purposely wanting to cause it for others. Again, take that scenario I gave you where people already envisioned and went out and spent the money before we were even done speaking.
Yeah.
And yet when things didn't work out, what I've saw over time is financial losses weren't anywhere near severe as the mental aspect of people having to deal with those financial losses.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's changed lives. And I don't think Wall Street teaches to this day its advisors to be cautious and to be overly cautious so to prevent or lessen potential mental anguish. I think people come in and see the best case scenario and never think out the worst case scenario. And I think mental anguish is far worse than actual financial losses. When I lost to that young broker, I was over the financial loss of it within 6 months. But it took me years to get over, especially when I came as stockbroker and I realized what he did to me. So the mental anguish is something to be very concerned about.
Yeah, it certainly is, and it's people. A lot of times, marriages are broken up, and lots of bad things happen when people lose money. And some people can actually look at the stock market as a gambling casino, which I guess you could make the case that's pretty much what it is a lot of times.
Well, just remember this before we get to the seventh and run out of time. Wall Street was very smart long before you and I entered it. They realized for a lot of things they do was gambling, but they created a word that turned it from gambling to sounding like it was investing, and it's called speculating.
Uh-huh.
But if you take the word speculating out, the next time you hear somebody use it and assert gambling, you'll realize that speculating and gambling are basically the same thing.
Right, I suppose so. Although I suppose you could make the case that when you're speculating, you're doing it on some information you believe to be correct. But in any event, procrastination. With 4 minutes left, we got time yet, Peter. Talk to us about procrastination.
Well, that's probably, it should be, if you reversed it, it wouldn't be bad to be number one versus number seven. For instance, right now, just about 80 to at least 90% of the people listening to us or listening to any financial program are operating on the basis their plan is an emotional one. They don't have any set guidelines. In other words, like you talked about the technician. Well, at least the technician has, hey, listen, if this hits this price, we need to sell or buy. Most people's plan right now is just flying by the seat of their pants. And then what happens, they will, they will just, you know, okay, it started to turn down, but what should I do now? And again, what they end up becoming is usually very good in a spiritual strategy, but it's a horrible investment strategy. They get into the hope scenario. Well, I just hope this stock goes back so I can get out of it. I just hope the market turns around so I can do this. Hope is a tremendous blessing that God gives us in general life, but it's a horrific strategy to take when it comes to investing. It doesn't work on hope. You have to have set plans, and one of the things I find, the very few people who don't, or, I'm sorry, the very few people that do, they don't procrastinate. They have set plans. If certain things take place, they take action. You know, it's the old story. Some people make things happen. Some people watch what happened, and some people wonder what happened. And you really have to make things happen when you're involved in a financial planning strategy.
Right. Well, I think probably when you buy something, have an exit strategy, I guess is what you're saying. That's one thing.
And have it set in stone and not fluctuate or say, well, let me just watch and see what happens. Again, it's one of the worst ways people can go about handling their finances.
No question about it. Well, Peter, with about 1 minute left yet, in a couple of days, we're going to have a new president. Any quick thoughts about that?
Well, I think the market rallied a tremendous amount on the expectations. I think it's priced in a lot of good things hopefully happening. I hope they happen, but I think it's going to be a lot tougher sled than people believe it's going to be. And I think right now, error on the side of caution. And again, I'm not into market timing or anything of that anymore. But maybe for another day, and I know it's your specialty, I myself, and just for myself, have mostly cash, gold, and a couple of gold stocks. I have really no general equity exposure at this time. That works for me. It may not work for a lot of others, but that's where I'm positioned.
Well, to the extent it works or makes sense, we want to get your thoughts along some of those lines too in the future, Peter. But mainly we want to talk to you about some of the other aspects that aren't so commonly discussed. We really do want to try to use your experience to turn hard times into good times. Thank you so much for being with us, Peter, and we'll look to do it again in a few weeks from now.
Thank you very much, Jay.
All right. Well, folks, that is all the time we have today. Next week, Richard Mayberry will be my guest. He'll have some very interesting things to say about President Trump then. When I ask him if Trump is America's last hope for survival, as Jim Rickards suggested on this show. In any event, be sure to tune in to Rick Mayberry next week. Thanks again for listening. Thanks to Tacy Trump, my producer, Matt Widener, my engineer. Thanks to all of you again for listening. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Dynacert is a global leader in carbon emission reduction technologies. Created for use in diesel engines, the hydrogen unit has been proven to reduce carbon emissions by up to 40%, increase torque, improve engine oil quality, and provide up to 19% in fuel savings. Our leading-edge technology is designed for tractor trailers, rail, marine, and newly developed for diesel engine cars. Reducing the amount of greenhouse gases provides benefits to the environment, to communities and businesses, and to our shareholders.
Golden Predator Mining Corp., a well-financed gold exploration company operating in Canada's Yukon. Focused on advancing its Three Aces project, a high-grade gold project located in the southeast Yukon with gold and quartz outcrops at surface. Ongoing work includes trenching, roadwork, drilling, and bulk sampling. Golden Predator also holds the part-producing Brewery Creek project located near Dawson City, Yukon. Golden Predator, a company working closely with Yukon First Nations. Golden Predator trades on the Canadian venture market as GPY and in the US OTC market as NTGSF.